I think I'd rather die in nuclear war than go to Olean.
Penn State was in the Atlantic.
Tired. Mark Whipple was a bad coach at UMass. Wired. Charlie Molnar was a bad coach at UMass. Inspired. Kevin Morris was a bad coach at UMass.
Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. My name is Curry Hicks Sage. I'm coming to you live from my apartment in New York City, late on a Tuesday night, February 25th, 2020. We will have an interview tonight with VCU beat writer for the Richmond Times-Dispatch, Wayne Epps Jr. He gives a solid overview of this Rams club and some of the struggles they've endured, and hopefully you'll listen to this on the way to the Mullen Center tomorrow for what is a surprisingly critical Atlantic 10 basketball game in late February. The last game, oh no, wait, I was going to say the last game in February, but I think Saturday is the 29th. There's it's a leap year, so UMass will have one more February game at another Richmond, Virginia-based opponent, but this time on the road, Saturday against a very good Richmond team. That being said, before we jump into all things UMass basketball tonight, I want to acknowledge, of course, the fine folks at Five College Movers, stress-free moving in the Pioneer Valley and beyond. Sponsor of the show, friend of UMass athletics, friend of UMass basketball, friend of UMass Twitter. If you or anyone you know is moving anywhere, go with Five College Movers. It's a no-brainer. Pat and all the guys there will take care of you. World-class folks, world-class operation. Smooth, accessible, seamless. If you're moving, there's only one way to do it. Five College Movers. Stress-free moving in the Pioneer Valley and beyond. All right. Let's jump right in here to some basketball action. The last time we had a show was just prior to the Dayton game, which feels like an eternity ago. It really wasn't. It was, I think the show came out on Valentine's Day? No. I don't know. I don't know when Bennett posted it. Maybe Valentine's Day. So maybe I did it the day before Valentine's Day. It's only like a week and a half ago, but it feels like a long time because that game, in a certain sense, marked the start of what has been a really good stretch of basketball for a UMass team that just 3.5 weeks ago looked to be dead in the water after that 35-point loss on the road at Davidson. UMass bounced back from that Davidson loss with a victory over, was it George Mason in the next game? Just trying to look at the schedule here. No. After Davidson, it didn't get any easier. They went on the road and played roadie, but they played hard and lost by 6, then came home, got the must-win over George Mason in rather dramatic fashion that shouldn't have been dramatic because they were winning by 14 or so with like 5 minutes left, ended up winning by 2 and almost gave that away. I lost my mind at the end of that one. Then Dayton came in here, and UMass played them really tough, a great crowd, generated some buzz for the program, and while there is no such thing as a moral victory, there is such a thing as a moral victory, and that was a moral victory. So I was very encouraged by that. They got a good crowd at the Mullen Center. A lot of folks were sort of like, oh, this team is actually kind of turning a corner. You know, I can see the future. Not that they were turning a corner, but people understood kind of what McCall was selling, if that makes sense. They played hard. They couldn't shoot the ball worth shit, but they played hard. Trey Mitchell was fantastic. You saw the game. I don't have to belabor it. The next game after that was the one that was actually most encouraging. I think, without question, the biggest win of the season. They overcame a 16-point deficit in the first half to defeat a Travis Ford-led St. Louis team, 67-63. And it just felt like something was qualitatively different. I actually have to go back and watch the first 10 minutes of the second half. I watched the first half at my office, came home and watched the second half of the second half at my place, and I was just jacked up, and it was an unbelievable, really was kind of unbelievable. I mean, the intensity they played with in coming back and, you know, just sort of they made winning plays. Trey Mitchell on the pick and roll with Sean East. I mean, that might have been the play of the season. The second, you know, maybe the only other play of the season was also in that game, which was the Carl Pierre three to break a tie, I believe. Guys made plays. And it just felt like, oh, this is what it means to evolve, to become a more experienced team late in February. All of the kind of cliche coach speak we heard from, you know, all summer, that, you know, we want to be a better team in February and March than we are in November, December, but that could feel difficult, you know, to conceive of as a reality after a February 1st blowout loss to Davidson, became real. It was like actualized. You felt like there was something there. And then, also significant, McCall's group went on the road, and I was there on Saturday. Great to see a lot of you there at Fordham, and won a game on the road in the Atlantic 10. They had lost 22 straight. The last time they won a game on the road in the Atlantic 10 under McCall was his first ever game on the road in the Atlantic 10 at Dayton 2+ years ago. According to friend of the show and founder of UMassHoops.com, Mike UMA, that snapped a 777-day A-10 road losing streak. And there's a small subset of people who are sort of like, oh, it was ugly, but we got it. No, it wasn't ugly. It was beautiful. Fordham plays everybody ugly. So yeah, it was ugly, but everybody, that's the way they play. They're like 343rd in defensive, you know, in tempo stats. Like, that's their game. And you just have to get out of there with a win. Even when they're halfway decent, that's your job. And it was a nice win. I don't care how bad Fordham is. They needed a road win, and Fordham plays an ugly style. UMass overcame it. Quite frankly, they could have won, I think, by a little bit more. But they did what they needed to do. Trey Mitchell took over down the stretch. Samba Diallo had the best game of the season. One or two games of the season. Tabaji Walker made some plays. It was just an incredible. And so in winning that game, UMass not only exceeded Matt McCall's first year A-10 win total of 5 and got to 6, but also exceeded last year's total win total, so going from 11 to 12, with a minimum of 5 games to play, possibly more, 4 regular season, 1 Atlantic 10 tournament at least, and who knows, maybe more. And they have definitively gotten over, you know, they've definitively improved on last season's record, which was, I think, a big deal, not just symbolically, but tangibly. But also, they did it against a much tougher schedule. The A-10 is a lot better this year. They played a much more difficult non-conference schedule. And so there's an alternate universe where, even against this schedule, with better health, and, you know, a couple things going their way. Just a truly heartbreaking loss against St. Louis to start conference play that really should have been a win. And I'd say, you know, the Yale game. I mean, and you can say this, you know, that we stole games too. But there's a real universe in which this team probably should be. And I don't want to say this lightly because, you know, we've had some things go our way. But it feels like this year with injuries and a couple tough losses that they've more gone away from us rather than gone for us. But this team could right now be 14-13, 7-7 in the league very easily, which I think most people would acknowledge would be really good. And then they could have won that Akron game. I mean, you don't want to look back on it, but the bottom line is 12-15 is pretty much where you'd expect this group to be if at the start of the season. I think I was hoping for 7 or 8 wins in the Atlantic 10 on the high end. Said I wouldn't be surprised with 6. And we now have an opportunity to do that. I mean, and tomorrow night at the Mullen Center, a preseason top 20 team is coming into the Mullen Center. UMass, I get into this in the interview, but UMass is the 345th youngest team in the country, or rather oldest team in the country. They're like the eighth youngest team in the country. Shout out to friend of the show, UMass Fan 33, for that stat. If it's not right, well, you can blame him, but it seems right to me. And VCU was in the top 50 in terms of experience. They brought back, I think, five seniors from a team that was like 16 and dominated the Atlantic 10 last year. A team that lost in the Atlantic 10 tournament, but then made the tournament anyway with like an 8 seed. It was really considered the prohibitive favorite to win the Atlantic 10 this year. I mean, people forget that Dayton was not a top 25 team. In fact, Davidson, a lot of people thought, was the number 2 team. Dayton was, you know, lingering in the 3-4 slot in most preseason predictions. VCU was the class of the league in the preseason rankings and played well to open the year. And in the last 4 games, they've been absolutely disastrous. They have, you know, dealt with the injury bug a bit. They have run into various other forms of adversity. But the brash-talking VCU Nation fan base is a little quieter at the moment after losing on the road to that same St. Louis team UMass beat 3 days prior by 18 points. That game, I think, was the first time I said, not only is VCU disappointing this year, but they're downright, you know, in a disastrous fall from grace this season. 17-10 overall, 7-7 in the league is perfectly respectable. UMass fans would, probably an organ for a season like that at the moment. But UMass doesn't have 5 seniors, and UMass wasn't in the tournament last year, and UMass wasn't a preseason top. In the non-conference, but if I recall right, they were respectable. Yeah, they lost to Tennessee by 3. They lost to Purdue by 3. They beat LSU and they beat everybody else. And I think they lost to Wichita State maybe as well. Yeah. So, but again, you know, respectable opponents, 3 losses. Probably a little disappointing for a team that was top 20, but, you know, a couple 3-point losses and one off night, you know, is not the end of the world. They enter conference play. They win their first 2 games, and then they lose a home game pretty early on to Rhodey. That, you know, raised some questions, but I think people were like, well, it's Rhodey, and Rhodey's actually really good. And then they lost to Dayton at Dayton, but everybody's like, well, Dayton is all everything, so it doesn't matter. They quickly bounce back. They blow out St. Bonaventure, and they continue playing good basketball, win like 4 or 5 in a row, beat a good Richmond team at home. I mean, it's the same city, but it's at home. It was at their place by 19. All is fine. You know, they're like 17-5, whatever it is. Then they lose to Rhodey on the road. Again, not great, but you're still sort of fringe at-large type team and entering February. And they go and they beat a respectable Davidson team. This is where things get weird. On Wednesday, so it's really just the slide that we're alluding to for VCU has been really in the last 2 weeks. They lose at home by 5 to a bad George Mason team. That's peculiar, right? You know, especially because they'd already lost twice to Rhodey and they'd lost to Dayton and they'd, you know, it was kind of like, okay, maybe this team isn't all it's cracked up to be. And now you're like, well, who are they at all? But, you know, let's see. They'll bounce back. Rivalry game with Richmond coming up. Nope. Lost by 18. Oh, well, they still have a chance to make the NCAA tournament because they need one more quality win. And here comes Dayton into their arena. Lose by 5 a week ago today. But, you know, you're like, all right, it's Dayton. And Richmond is now basically a tournament team. So two straight losses to tournament teams. Maybe they're not, you know, a tournament team anymore, but they're still respectable, right? Maybe that George Mason game was an aberration. They just lost to St. Louis by 18. So they're coming into the Mullen Center tomorrow night on a four-game skid. It is the first four-game skid for that program in 20 years. Not since 2000. February of 2000 has VCU lost four straight. So UMass is riding a two-game win streak. They've won three of four, plus a respectable couple losses against the top of the league. They have a chance to pass VCU in the standings. They'd be tied, but they would own the tiebreaker, and I believe that would take UMass from 10th to 8th, maybe 9th, depending on some other outcomes. That's miraculous. It's downright miraculous. And there's a part of me, I gotta be honest, that still is envisioning VCU will kind of get over their shit and play fantastic. You know, you see those games where a team feels like a team. There's always the teams that when they're on a skid, eventually they're going to break that skid. And they're just going to play really great basketball and you're going to be the victim of it. But the truth is, Marcus Evans, and we'll talk to our guests about a lot of this stuff tonight, is out. And he kind of made that team tick. Isaac Van and Deriante Jenkins have not had the types of years that they were kind of, I think, that people were expecting. They've not put up the big time numbers. They do have some a really good freshman guard who will fill in for Marcus, but they aren't as deep. He's not the only one injured. There's another guy banged up, and they're playing like eight or nine guys. And Marcus Santos Silva, a Massachusetts kid from Taunton, is, you know, not as big of a concern for me because we have Trey Mitchell now. I mean, it's amazing to say that because Santos Silva's a very good player. He's like, I want to say he's probably 6'7", 6'8", but he's like 250. He's just a big dude. You'll recall Mo Ali Cox years back at VCU. They always seem to have a big dude in the middle. But Trey Mitchell has feasted on every allegedly awesome A-10 big man this year, including Obi Toppin, who's going to be a top five pick. He dominated. He's dropped 30 on Langevin at Rhode Island. He dropped 24 against Hassan French the other night from St. Louis. I mean, the kid, like, let's just stop the program for a second. Bennett, maybe do it, you know, like a scratch, the narrator voice comes on. What we're witnessing with Trey Mitchell cannot be overstated. And I don't make claims like that a lot in this program. He's the best basketball player in terms of true freshmen to come to UMass since Marcus Camby. He is that good. The way in which he's dominating right now, he's now on three straight A-10 Rookie of the Week awards. And they try to spread those awards around, by the way. They would love nothing more than to find other guys in the league to give it to. The way he's dominating is really without peer. John Bugs, the injured UMass guard, tweeted last night that he's been watching a lot of college basketball and that there's no big man better in the country. That may be slightly hyperbolic, and admittedly, having recently had a second kid, I've not watched nearly the amount of college basketball I do in some years this season. But other than the kid at Kansas and maybe a few others, I just don't think there are many guys out there right now who are smoother in the post, more polished with their back to the basket in college basketball today than Trey Mitchell. Five or ten guys who are up there. But the way he's dominated of late, it's just freakishly impressive. Now, even against Fordham, he went like 5 for 21. So people not watching that game may have the wrong impression. First of all, he got fantastic looks, and sometimes shots just aren't going to go down. But the point about Mitchell is, no matter how well he's defended, he gets good looks. So even if he has an off night, you're like, well, he'll get it going eventually because he's right by the rim. And sure enough, two or three of those misses, he followed up with a dunk. Like, there was a play late in the second half where he missed it and then dunked his own miss. I mean, these were big-time plays. He was getting absolutely mauled by 3-4 of defenders, just hanging on his arm. It was the kind of thing where they could have called a foul on every possession and probably would have if you're at home. You get, you know, he got some calls in the second half, but you get those calls at home, right? And then it forces teams to be a little less physical, and then he goes to work. Though he had 30 at Rhode Island, so it's not just a Mullen Center phenomenon by any means. But he just kept persevering, and he got 19 rebounds. And that was an off night. You know, I mean, this kid is going to find a way to get, on a bad night, 14, 15, 16. And if Pierre or Walker or some of the other guys can finally start shooting the three ball like they were early in the season, and it's since become the worst in-conference three-point shooting team in the league, UMass could be pretty fucking dangerous late in the year. I mean, they're triple-teaming Trey at this point. He's still getting points, and he's kicking out beautifully. We're just not making shots. So I don't know how I got in this, what the tangent was, but going back to tomorrow night's game, if Trey can get it going and get Santo Silva in a little bit of trouble and their backup is out, it could be a long night for VCU. Conversely, VCU guards still pressure the shit out of the basketball, and UMass, let's be candid, and this is another big theme I want to hit on for tonight, we're still not there when it comes to point guard. I so wish that Colton Mitchell's defense and Sean East's best offense were all in one human being, but they're not. They're in two different human beings. And the reality is, as it's been all year, other than kind of the first five games, we are relying on a freshman duo at point guard, neither of whom are A-10 all rookie team type players right now, beginning of the season for East notwithstanding. And the reality is, you need a really good point guard if you want to take that next step in this league. And I believe, and I've said it on the program a number of times, that Javon Garcia, currently at Brewster Academy doing a post-grad year and coming in next year, will start from day one, and that he is an absolutely fantastic point guard. I have similarly high hopes as I had for Trey Mitchell. His tape, in many ways, is more impressive. I don't think he'll be as dominant, doesn't have to be, as Mitchell. And I don't want to set expectations to such an egregious degree. But even if he's just, let's say, Colton's defense and Sean's offense, and I think he'll be a little bit better on both ends than those two on their best end, you turn this team next year into a dangerous basketball team in the Atlantic 10. When you think of TJ Weeks coming back, when you think of Tabaji Walker having not had to sit out 12, 13 games, and having certainty around his game, when you think about Trey Mitchell with another year to get strong in the offseason, and when you think about Carl Pierre as a senior, and then you add a point guard who can get downhill, who's bang-bang and just can go end-to-end quick and can defend and lock down an opposing point guard, that's a whole different basketball team than you have right now. And right now, there's been some really encouraging signs. But we don't have a point guard who we can reliably, for whom we can reliably put the ball in his hands late in a game, and just feel like we'll put it to bed. You know, I think that to some degree what happened against Fordham, to some degree what happened against George Mason, you know, you can attribute to the fact that we're not totally all locked in offensively at the one in terms of running things at the end of the game. Now, Sean East can also become that guy over time. But remember, he's a freshman. He's still a freshman. I know some of these guys are emerging now and playing like sophomores and juniors. But the reality is that critical of a position, it's tough to put a not kind of all everything freshman in that predicament. So some would say, well, why? What makes you think Garcia is different? Go watch his tape. I can't explain it. He's just got a different affect. I just love everything about the kid's game. If he's not what I think he is, we'll cross that bridge when we get there. But I think that's a big factor. Now, I've also said in past episodes, this team doesn't have a takeover guard who can score. And I think if you get the Femi Okudalu kid from Springfield Commonwealth next year, plus Cairo McCrory, who's 6'5", and at Woodstock Academy right now and can do that, I mean, you have more pieces. But even if you don't have that kid, Garcia can get in the lane. I mean, he can really get in the lane at will. And, you know, shots okay, not great, has to improve. But you're going to be able to surround him with two and three shooters at all times, plus Trey Mitchell down low. And that's why it doesn't really matter if he's not a great three-point shooting threat. So anyway, I don't know how I got on that rant. The point is, what we're still lacking is consistency at the one and shooting ability right now. We've got to shoot better. I mean, it's kind of miraculous that we're playing as well as we've been, given how poorly we're shooting. We shot like 4 for 20 from three against Dayton and still almost beat them. Not almost beat them, but we hung with them. You know, you have to think at some point Carl Pierre is going to have, you know, he played better at Fordham, but that he's going to have a 12 for 20 night. I mean, you know, a 9 for 16 night that we've seen him have in the past. And if he can, we'll be able to overcome pretty much any opponent in the league other than Richmond in our final four games. But VCU is going to teach us a lot because they're going to pressure the shit out of our young point guards. They still have seniors who are going to say, fuck this. We're not losing to these kids. We're going to go on the road, and this is going to be a business trip. You don't know if they're going to overcome their struggles. I hope they don't, but they could come in a moment tomorrow night and just hit us with the power of 1,000 suns with respect to their defensive intensity. And if we're not ready for that, this game could be over quick. Conversely, they could continue struggling, not have their kind of lead guard, and Santos Silva could get in foul trouble against Trey Mitchell, and all of a sudden UMass has a win over a team that 3 months ago you would have said is a 20-point loss. So again, it's a great learning opportunity for UMass. I think, you know, I've noted on Twitter, but this would be the third straight game. It's the third straight game in which McCall can defeat a team that he hasn't yet beaten. And, you know, he did it against St. Louis. He did it against Fordham. Still hasn't beaten GW or St. Bonaventure. But it would be, you know, you're playing for something here. You surpass them in the standings. You then have a shot, you know, next week at LaSalle to that would take you to 8 wins if you win tomorrow night. And, you know, I think a senior day against a roadie is a winnable basketball game. So you're very much playing for a 500 season in A-10 play still. Conversely, you don't get the win, and now you're on the road at a difficult Richmond team who's expected to make the tournament by a lot of people. And then another road game at LaSalle. It's not easy. And then a roadie team at home that, you know, is probably going to finish second in the league. So, you know, it's a big game. I think, again, and they've taken care of business in the last two, which has been incredibly encouraging because I honestly thought there was a chance they could end the season 0-6 because none of those games are automatics. And so I think this is just another chance to kind of prove that we've turned the corner. And the biggest thing beyond the emergence of Trey, the two biggest things I think are the fact that we've started to mix in some zone and that I think we become more unpredictable defensively. We're holding teams to way fewer points than we were before. And that's a function of the second thing I was going to talk about, which is effort. They just fucking play harder now. They don't have those long lapses. They did a little bit against St. Louis, but then they overcame that, which was quite impressive because St. Louis is not a bad team. If UMass can play for 40 minutes and, you know, they can continue to limit turnovers and lock in defensively, there's no reason they can't beat this VCU team tomorrow night. It could go a lot of ways. I don't really want to make a prediction. I'm getting awfully tired. I'm excited for it. But I really do think, like, this is the kind of game that if you win, You now have a lot to point to in the offseason when you're selling tickets. You have a lot to point to when you're selling recruits. You have a lot to point to when you're looking forward to Brooklyn and maybe stealing a win or two down there. So let's see what they can do. The following game against Richmond on the road will be extraordinarily difficult. I don't expect a whole lot out of that, given our road woes, but that's why tomorrow becomes all the more important. UMass is 10-4 at home. They've been a solid home team. The only game that was kind of got out of hand was the George Washington game, and there's no reason to think that UMass hasn't turned the corner from that one, and I'm excited to see what happens. So things are looking up, but, you know, there's some more basketball to be played, and I think we're going to learn a lot about this team in terms of what to look forward to next year as the season moves on here with the final four or five games. And I got to admit, I'm also just getting sad because it always feels like, oh, how is it ending? I didn't do enough podcasts. I barely watched the game on my phone, and I watched the game on my phone. I couldn't see it well. And, you know, you just start getting sad. I was at the Fordham game, and I was just like, man, I can't believe it's going to end soon. I'm going to have 8 months of just, you know, thinking about the next year and wondering why I didn't watch the Akron game because I went to a Fish concert, and, you know, why I got stuck late at work and didn't get to watch the full George Mason game. And wait, do I know this team? When did they play well? You know, just all the fucking obsessive, crazy shit that goes through your brain when you're following a team of basically dubious national significance for the entirety of a season with an intensity unknown to mankind and a passion matched by only my friends on UMass Twitter. All right, let's get this interview going. Okay, it's our pleasure tonight to bring on to the UMass Basketball Podcast a first-time guest. He is a bit of a traditional journalist. Usually we go with a more online kind of out there folks, and we've had Matt Shelton eyed in the past, but I haven't seen him on Twitter lately, so I went the more traditional route, and we have brought on, we have the good pleasure of having with us tonight Wayne Epps Jr., who is the VCU beat reporter for the Richmond Times-Dispatch, and he's been covering the team, I think. Which is funny because Josh Walfish, who covers UMass for the Daily Hampshire Gazette, used to cover JMU. And in the off season, Wayne covers the Richmond Squirrels AA baseball team, whose voice was formerly, or play-by-play voice was formerly Jay Burnham, the voice of UMass basketball and UMass football. So some funny connections there. But without further ado, Wayne, welcome to the show. Glad to have you on tonight.
Definitely, thanks for having me.
And I gotta ask you. I mean, I presume it's been a pretty interesting season covering VCU. I always think that if I were a beat reporter, I think I would be more drawn, kind of narratively speaking, to seasons like this where expectations are you know, where teams do not hit the expectation, because I just think there's more storylines in that. As a fan, if I were a VCU fan, I'd be extremely frustrated. I'm curious how kind of your expectations for this season, what they were they as high as others, and how surprised you've been by what's played out.
Yeah, I had more expectations just because of sort of wrongly VCU finished last year. Of course, they won their final 12, 18 games. Had a little hiccup. You know, Marcus Evans, of course, got hurt against Rhode Island in their quarterfinal game. They lost that. And then with the hot one, Marcus Evans, they lost the Eastern game in the first round of the NCAA tournament. But still, you know, expecting everybody to come back healthy, having 5 seniors this year, 7 total upperclassmen. I definitely had big expectations. Obviously, VCU was picked to win the A-10 this year and was preseason top 25 as well. So, you know, that kind of matched my expectations for the year. I expected, just like I said, for them to kind of carry that strong finish of the year onto this year, which they did. They got off to their first 6-0 start in program history. They beat then 23-ranked LSU at home when former coach Will Wade came back to the Siegel Center. And it was a pretty overall strong start to the year. Then they started, you know, hitting a little couple of hiccups here and there. They lost to Wichita State, pretty bad out in Wichita. It was the second game of a home-to-home. And then, you know, they gave Dayton a run when Dayton was 13 ranked back in January. They gave them a run at home. But Dayton went on a huge 22-0 run and pulled away and kind of ended up kind of blowing VCU out in that game. He just saw some inconsistency issues pop up. They kind of you saw also some a little bit of injury issues as well. Marcus Evans was suspended in January, and he suffered a knee injury in January. That's kind of limited. I mean, now he's kind of been put on the shelf for the time being. Some of it can't be explained, again, with some of the injury issues they've had, with Marcus Evans not being, probably all year, hasn't been 100%. And recently they just lost Corey Douglas, who's been the backup center and also a backup power forward. He's dealing with a foot issue. So that's some, you can pin some of the problems on that. But some of the problems just kind of seem a little bit unexplainable. We've seen some of the seniors maybe not have the year that they expected, like guys like Isaac Vann and Deontay Jenkins, we've seen some good things from some other guys, like some of the freshmen, like Bones Highland, has been one of the best freshmen in the conference, but sort of that backbone, he expected to carry what happened last year. Years, they just haven't really had the years that people expected, and that's kind of all culminated in this sort of dip here that they've had here.
So, going back to the original question, has that been a surprise? It's been surprising for you to follow, or has it kind of made sense if you've watched the whole thing play out?
Yeah, it's been surprising just because, I expected, I guess, sort of seniors to perform a little bit better, perform, I guess, sort of like seniors and see them kind of step up and lead the team. Like last year, Marcus Evans, after he transferred from Rice, he followed Mike Rose from Rice. He sat out the 17-18 season, so last year was his first year at VCU. And he kind of came in and was that guy who could kind of take over a game for VCU, you know, and he basically had the game-winning shots in both the VCU games against Dayton last season. So with him not being full health this year, you know, they lost that kind of strong mentality type of guy who could kind of get over a game when needed. And then against some other seniors like the Deontay Jenkins and Isaac Vann,
and then I kind of haven't watched a ton of VCU, and to follow the kind of slow demise that then became rapid, if that makes sense, has been very odd from afar, because, you know, they had an unbelievable year in conference last year. They brought pretty much everybody back, right?
And then
you know, it started off where you're kind of just like, all right, well, maybe they're underachieving a little. You know, they lost some close games, like Rhode Island's better than people thought. It's, you know, respectable losses. And then all of a sudden they lose to George Mason at home, and I'm just like, what's going on here? You do not lose to George Mason. This George Mason team, you know, at the Stew there in Richmond, a tough place to play. And then they get another crack at Dayton, who's really good, play them tough, lose, but I'm still like, okay, so they had one bad loss to George and they lost to a really good Dayton team. You know, they'll eventually get it together. And then they just get blown out against, you know, a decent St. Louis team, but frankly, a St. Louis team that was coming off of a loss to a freshman-laden UMass group, and they lost by like 18. And at that point, I'm just looking at this team that's lost four in a row, that is, frankly, a loss away tomorrow night from being beneath the 345th youngest team in college basketball in UMass in the conference standings. And this VCU team is a top 50 team in terms of college experience. It's all there. They had it humming last year, so it's sort of hard to pin it on Rhodes. What has gone wrong in the last few games, in particular that St. Louis game?
I think you see a little bit of pressing, honestly. You know, I think one thing Mike Rhodes was talking about, you know, again, having five seniors coming back, I think the expectation from looking from the outside in was, you know, you expected that they kind of carry them in close games, kind of carry them in big games, and that experience would kind of pay off. But one thing Mike Rhodes was talking about a little bit this year is that sometimes when you have seniors, they actually, you know, press because they realize sort of their window is closing, especially when you have a stretch like this where, you know, they're kind of sliding here and they're not living up to the expectations they have. You start putting pressure on yourself and kind of making it uncharacteristic mistakes. I think you're maybe kind of seeing that a little bit from some of these seniors that we, you know, have those high expectations from. And also sort of one of the themes in a lot of their losses this year is they kind of have these runs, or a lot of these opponents that go on runs where sort of the wheels come off. Again, against at Dayton on January 14th, they were in that game, were playing well to start the second half, and then Dayton went on a 22-0 run to pull away at Rhode Island on the 31st. Rhode Island went on a 17-2 run to pull away. Then against George Mason at home the other week, George Mason went on a 16-0 run. And then at St. Louis on Friday, St. Louis went on a 17-0 run. I think what we see in some of those runs are, again, it goes back to that pressing where, you know, a team has scored a couple quick baskets, and so VCU is sort of like they try to get those home run plays. I try to get it all back at once, maybe take an ill-advised three, trying to maybe play a little bit of a hero ball a little bit, trying to get it all back at once. And, you know, taking those bad shots sometimes allows an opponent to get off on runoffs and score in transition, catch a rebound, score in transition, and all of a sudden, you know, a 6-0 run turns into a 10-0 run, and a 10-0 run turns into a 14-0 run, and it keeps going when you're not kind of sticking to the plan and playing within the offense. So I think we've seen that sometimes away from them to kind of do that, which again, with the experienced team, you expect them not to really have some of those issues, but I think sometimes they realize where they're at and realize what expectations were and trying to fight for that, try to get it all back at once, and it just doesn't work. So I think they're kind of dealing with that a little bit right now, and they're trying some different lines and stuff to kind of, I think, break them out of this rut here. And you know, obviously, when you're changing things up like that at the end of the year, that's not really a good sign, so we'll see if they're able to kind of break out of it moving forward. But
is there a sense that there might be issues at all in that locker room? I mean, the seniors that you're alluding to as, you know, struggling a bit, the truth is they're not Mike Rhodes recruits, and I think sometimes, you know, it can be the case that, you know, they're loyal to the predecessor, and sometimes you can, for one reason or another, those things go away for a couple seasons. But Rhodes did have a challenging first season in Richmond, and then, you know, quickly turned it around and had a great year last year. But they are Will Wade's, you know, guys, and I'm curious, you know, if there's questions around that program right now about chemistry, or if it's just kind of seen as a, you know, a slide that can be explained by, you know, standard kind of bad play and struggles on the offensive end.
I would lean towards saying that, you know, it's just the on-court things, because, you know, last year, which is not always easy when you're having a last year, there's just so much talk about how close this group was, just how good the chemistry was, and sort of the army approach, as Mike Rose said, a lot of work, you know, obviously they play a lot of guys, play usually 11 guys per game, because of the style of play, and usually, you know, it takes some unselfish guys to do that, because you sacrifice know, your own stats, your own minutes when you're subbing so frequently as ECU does. And that was sort of talk a lot last year, just you know, guys being willing to do that. And so, you know, again, that makes me lean towards saying that, you know, it's hard, sorry to say that, you know, after being so close last year, they kind of all fall apart with this. But again, with losing, sometimes maybe like I said, I would lean towards saying just the on-court thing. You kind of just seen it compound here recently with the injuries and everything like that, with them kind of sliding in the standings here. The pressure has kind of been on. So that's what I would lean towards pinning their problems on.
So when VCU is playing well, as they were in the beginning of the season, and even for much of conference play, I mean, their slide has been relatively recent. They were 17-6 just a couple weeks ago. What is it that they're doing well when they're playing well? I mean, like, if they're playing their style and their tempo, kind of what does that look like?
Well, first off, you know, it's forcing turnovers. You know, last year, you know, they were one of the top defensive teams in the country. You know, particularly in the field goal percentage defense, they've kind of slipped in those categories this year, both the overall field goal percentage defense and the 3-point percentage defense. But this year, they still kind of remain high in the, you know, turnover percentage and steal percentage. So they love to obviously be able to create turnovers, use their press to create turnovers and create easy baskets. That kind of gets some momentum going. And then they try to capitalize on the momentum in the half court. You know, they'll play inside out. Allows Marcus Santos Silva to get some paint touches. And Marcelo Silva, really, he really exploded last year. He's played well overall this year, but he's very good at sort of finding the open man on the perimeter. If nothing's there for him, and then they can kind of take advantage of that, get some open shots. I think you've seen the problems that they've been a little bit on offense. I think we've seen it a lot in these last four games, but when they're playing well, they're rushing the ball well, moving the ball well, sharing the ball well. That's what leads to good offense, good shots for them. And we've seen that kind of dip in these last few games. So, again, overall, when they're playing well, they're forcing turnovers, capitalizing on them, and they're also sharing the ball well, and all those things are kind of taking a dip here. So.
And Van in particular, I mean, I think he was a transfer from Maine. He's a Connecticut kid. I recall him being really good last year, and even in 17-18. His numbers have fallen off a good bit. He's averaging 7, whereas he was averaging like 11 last year, 10 the year before. I was really good at Maine, but different type of program where he was at like 16. And then you mentioned that, you know, Evans's injuries have kind of plagued him all year and that he's not expected to go tomorrow night. So what's the VCU guard situation like right now?
Sort of the guy who's been a standout really is Tyler, the freshman point guard out of Delaware. Sort of a late spring signee, you know, for the 2020 or for 2019 recruiting class. And you know, he's really been VCU's best 3-point shooter. He's really showing a lot of confidence. As a freshman, he's really he's seen Reddy kind of from the get-go and really kind of turn on here in conference play. He mentioned that the game at Dayton, he scored 16, back on January 14th at Dayton. He felt like that was money for good thing. He's a very good ball handler. And I think he's just like Bellinger, where he had a lot of confidence as well right out of the gate. So I expect to see a lot of him tomorrow. So he gets a lot of good contributions from some younger guys. And then Lee Corfo off the bench provides some good contributions as well.
So it seems like Marcus Evans is there any tension in terms of the lead guard, because it feels like Highland is kind of taking some of the I mean, it seems like he's been more impressive than Evans. Is he kind of emerging now? Evans isn't expected to play tomorrow, correct?
Yeah, he's on the shelf for the time being. I would be surprised.
And I mean, his minutes have been down all year. Like he's averaging under 24 minutes a game, and as a freshman at Rice, he was at 34. You know, and a sophomore there, he was at 32. Now some of that is because of the way VCU plays, where they play a lot of guys, and he doesn't have to be quite the marquee dude. But you know, even last year, he was at 27, and he was banged up a bit last year. It's kind of a sad story with him, right? Like he's been plagued by injuries, you know, basically since the middle of last season.
Well, even going back to his first summer at VCU in 2017, he tore one Achilles tendon. But obviously, he was sitting out that year due to the transfer rules, and he rehabbed and got back. And then after he got healthy again, getting ready for his first eligible season in the summer of 2018, he tore his other Achilles. Kind of miraculously, able to play in the summer last year. And then ended up not missing any games last year at all, even after he got hurt in the A-10 tournament. This year he's been banged up. He's had very sort of, you say, minor injury stuff he's been able to play through. He was sick a lot through January. He had a stomach virus and flu. He had a concussion, suffered a concussion at Dayton on the 14th last month. Practice late last month, he sprained his MCL. And then, again, that was when he kind of reactivated that against Mason. And that's what it's been about. It's been a rash of injuries. Also to mention, of course, in the 18th tournament last year, he had a bone bruise in that left knee. So the same knee that's keeping him out now. So, yeah, it's been, like I said, it's been kind of sad because he was very hyped coming out of Rice. He had a lot of big programs after him. He decided to kind of come back closer to home, Bower Rose, to VCU. And, one of his obviously big goals has been to make a run in the NCAA tournament. And last year, they get to the NCAA tournament after Michigan in 17-18, and he was out in the first round. This year, just going to take an A-10 tournament win for them to get in the tournament at all. And so it's just sort of with this potential, if he had been healthy throughout this time, it would have been a lot different story, I think, for him and for the team overall. But, just battled so much, and it's kind of corresponded with what's happened to the team as a whole, too, so.
What's the mood with the fan base there? VCU has one of the most passionate, certainly online fan bases in the A-10, if not the country. And you know, they were pretty chirpy in the off season and pretty fired up to win the league this year. There was a lot of confidence and obviously a lot of very high expectations. Seems like now, I mean, I know it's probably not enveloped the entire fan base, but I've definitely seen some people already questioning, Rice's ability, Mike Rhodes' ability, if he's the guy, and just kind of that stuff. That's pretty common when a team who's been very successful for so long has some struggles. What's the mood around Richmond and kind of, especially with University of Richmond so successful this year, and the tables turned a bit because for so long it was about firing Mooney. Is that dynamic playing out in your reporting? Are you noticing kind of just the frustration of the fans, and is that kind of getting in the locker room?
Yeah, definitely noticed the frustration. Like I said, on social media, I think the word that describes the best is just sort of like antsiness. Like I said, they've had so much success over the years. I think the fans have kind of gotten used to having that perennial success. Obviously, before Michael first made 7 straight NCAA tournaments, they made it back last year. They're always towards the top of the A-10. I think they won the most games in the A-10 since they joined in 2012, 2013. So they're used to success. They're not used to this type of a dip like this. So I think, and then like you said, when Richmond is you know, where they're at, you know, they're right on the end of the tournament bubble. You know, they have a pretty good chance of getting in if they take care of business here down the stretch. You know, that thing it kind of compounds out a little bit. So I will say some of the I guess the extreme comments you see on Twitter. I think that's a small segment of the fan base. I think the majority kind of a little bit more realistic about where things are and understand some of the injury issues that they're dealing with and things like that. That can lead to this, but I definitely have seen some of the wilder comments on Twitter as well too. And you know, it's easy to say, you know, you block out the noise. That's one thing I really talk about a lot is sort of block out the noise. But I think everybody sees that stuff all the time. You can't help it, you know, sometimes. So I wouldn't be surprised if some of that has maybe seeped into locker room a little bit as well, and maybe can kind of contribute to that. Like I said, that some of that pressing, some of that pressure that maybe some of the guys feel. Because of the expectations that they had exit this year, and because of the pedigree of ECU making the NCAA tournaments, you know, usually perennially, and for these seniors to maybe miss out in their last year, I think that's a heavy weight on them for sure.
So the season is coming to an end here. You guys have a game at UMass tomorrow, and then I think you only have two more for the season. I think you've played because VCU's 7-8. Am I making that in conference?
7-7.
Okay, so same amount as UMass. They finished the year. I'm just trying to pull up their schedule here. They finished the year after. You're not actually at UMass for the trip, I understand. Right. Do you guys have anyone covering that, by the way? The Richmond Times? Is that like a, or is it just an AP account?
No, yeah, I'll cover it. I'll watch it on TV and I'll cover it that way. So.
Oh, but will you send someone to get quotes in the locker room?
Always has their radio guys up there for every away game, so they usually interview Rose after the game. So I'll take those quotes and use that in my write-up and do it that way. So yeah,
got it. So so then they have GW at the Stew, then they have Duquesne at the Stew, and then they end the season at Davidson. So tomorrow's kind of a key game if they're gonna at home, and you know the VCU game and George Washington are winnable, but tomorrow's like sort of a surprisingly important game, I think, just for them to stay north of 500 in the year's end. Have a prediction for us?
Yeah, you know, like I said, I think it's gonna be a tough game for them. They've kind of been a little bit shaky. Again, it seems like, you know, that UMass is kind of picking up a little bit of steam here. I know, you know, UMass has had a lot of young pieces, and, you know, but they won three out of the last four and seem to maybe be gaining a little bit of confidence, and Trey Mitchell is playing really, really well in his recent stretch. So I think it's going to be a close game. I'll say, you know, if Bones Highland is healthy and able to go, and, you know, it's, you know, as close to 100% as can be, you know, with that little hip flexor strain, I think I'll say maybe 72, 64, something like that. Within 10, could be even closer than that. But I'll say VCU is able to kind of right the ship here.
Eight points, kind of a lot at the Mullen Center. I mean, UMass just lost to Dayton by 8 at home, and you know, has besides one disastrous performance against GW, they've been really good at home. But that, okay. 8 points. Question before I make a prediction, because I haven't watched enough VCU. If anyone in the league can stop Mitchell, it would be Santo Silva. But the truth is, Mitchell went for 26 against Obi Toppin, 30 against Cyril Langevin, 24 against Hassan French on St. Louis. He's basically dominated every single highly regarded big man in the league. And I think at home, the truth is you just get some calls. Worth noting that Santo Silva is a Massachusetts kid, so maybe he'll have, you know, family there or whatever. But are you confident that Santo Silva can stop Mitchell?
Yeah, yes, but it is going to hinge on him being able to stay out of foul trouble. That's one thing that's kind of hurt him in his recent stretch where they lost four in a row. And St. Louis, the physical team, he got in foul trouble midway through the first half, and that kind of corresponded with the start of San Luis was 17-0 run and kind of just exploded the middle because he was out of the game and wasn't able to provide that defensive presence. So he's going to have to stay out of foul trouble. If he does get in foul trouble, then, I think things could go a little south for BC because, again, Corey Douglas is out. He's sort of in the backup center. They'll have to go to Hassan Ward, who's a freshman. He also played in Massachusetts.
Yeah, Springfield Central, right? Actually, really close to UMass, like because UMass, just so you know, is not really anywhere near Boston, and it's interesting because there's not a lot of kids who go to high level D1 schools out of Western Mass, and so I was looking at Ward today. I was surprised that UMass. I think we did recruit him at one point, but yeah, you're saying he's basically the third option if there's foul trouble to Santos Silva.
Yeah, well, he'll be the second option tomorrow because again, Corey Douglas won't play. And Hassan is showing a lot of good things, but he's kind of unpolished. He moved to Massachusetts from Barbados to start high school, and he really only has been playing organized basketball in the United States since his sophomore year of high school at Springfield Central. So he's still fairly new to the game, and some parts of his game, particularly offensively, are kind of unpolished. He has a lot of athleticism. He's good for at least two alley-oop dunks per game. But, again, he's still learning things. So if Santos Silva's in foul trouble, he's in the game against Trey Mitchell. You know, I think Trey might be able to exploit that.
So a lot of VCU's defense these days, particularly on the inside, is contingent upon Santos Silva being in there.
Yeah, for sure. We've seen some good things from their foreman, Vince Williams. He's a star the last couple of games. He's a physical player. But again, just, you know, like I said, for a true post player like Trey Mitchell, they're really just the main guys from Santos Silva. And again, he needs to be able to stay on the floor. If he's out, then I think Trey can be able to exploit that, and that could be a problem. That could be the difference for sure, just him being able to stay on the floor out of foul trouble. That's what St. Louis exploited when they pulled away. So
yeah, and I think that's the challenge of playing on the road in the Atlantic 10. Where I mean, I really do think officiating on the road in college basketball is a whole different game. And I say that as a UMass fan. I think UMass gets calls at home, and I think they get, you know, no calls on the road. So it'll be very interesting to see how this one plays out. If I think particularly for VCU, because they really got to stop the bleeding here, or things are going to get ugly. Anything you want to promote? We usually tell our guests, you know, if there's like where to find you on Twitter or anything we should know that you know you want to tell us about the program or what you're up to personally.
Yeah, I'll just say you can find our coverage at richmond.com. It's on Twitter at Wayne F. Jr. I cover VCU, and then John O'Connor covers Richmond for us. We have a guy called Mike Marvin covers UVA in Tech. So if you're interested at all in Virginia hoops, we kind of got you covered. So that's where you can find out work. So.
Good year for college basketball in the Commonwealth.
Yeah, for sure. Last year was very fun. Liberty was playing well. Tech and UVA. UVA obviously went on to win the national championship. VCU back in the tournament. That was really fun. This year's been a little bit more inconsistent, a little bit up and down. For a time, that looked like UVA was going to miss the tournament too. They kind of played their way back in. VCU's going to have a little battle, of course. But Richmond has a good shot this year. Liberty will. That's going to win the Big South. So it's always fun when who's wide in the Commonwealth.
And in general, in the city of Richmond, of the people who kind of follow basketball closely, is it overwhelmingly pro VCU, or is it like, my sense is from afar is it's kind of like 70-30 VCU Richmond, with the VCU 70 a lot louder than the Richmond 30, but this year it might feel a little different.
No, that's pretty accurate. It's like 30,000 plus, so a pretty big student body, pretty big alumni base, and it's kind of interesting the way it trends. Like, you'll find a lot of VCU alumni will end up staying, if not Richmond, just in Virginia in general. While a lot of Richmond alumni are kind of from the Northeast area, and I think a lot of those, when they graduate, will end up going back closer to home themselves. So know, in Richmond and Virginia, I think that VCU fan base is bigger and also, like you said, louder too. Except when the Richmond fan base is putting up Byron Mooney billboards on 95 like they did last year. But yeah, other than that, the VCU fan base is definitely larger, I would say. So just because of the way the student populations are.
I assume this year the folks, the Richmond fans, are kind of making their voices heard, though.
Yeah, for sure. There's always some good banter, particularly when those two teams play. Play twice a year, of course, and there's always some good banter. And honestly, you know, it's kind of cool to see because, again, they had a dip last year. They had the whole billboard situation where some dysfunctional fans bought a billboard on 95.
Yeah, Fire Mooney, yeah.
So to see them be able to rebound the way they have is pretty cool. I'm always just a fan of just good basketball in general, so it's cool to see. I'm from outside of Richmond, so I was in high school in 2011 when both teams made the Sweet 16, and of course VCU ended up going to the Final Four, and that was cool to see. So it's always fun to see when there's two good teams in Richmond. So.
Got it. Well, thanks so much for coming on and giving us a little bit of your time, and definitely check out on Twitter, and yeah, thanks for coming on.
Definitely, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
All right, mailbag time. Mailbag, like the rest of the program, brought to you by the fine folks at Five College Movers. Are you moving? Do you want to move? Is it maybe just time to shake up your life? Do it with Five College Movers. Maybe you don't even want to move. You just kind of want to go somewhere. Let the guys take you there. Maybe they just take you to I don't know where I'm going with this ad read. You know the drill. Call Pat and the gang. Five College Movers. Stress-free moving in the and beyond. Friends of this program. Friends of UMass Basketball. Friends of UMass Twitter. Friends of UMass Athletics. Hit them up. Check them out. Move with Five College Movers. Okay. Mailbag. First question tonight comes from the great Chad Miller, Mad_Chiller, right here in New York City. Caught him in the corner of my eye at the Fordham game. Sorry we didn't get to connect. He says, can we make a run at this thing? I don't quite know what he's referring to by this thing. I presume that he is referring to the Atlantic 10 tournament. And the dream is always that, you know, you have kind of a mediocre season, but you're peaking by the end of the year, and you pull an upset, and you make a run at it. Not necessarily win it, but make a run at it. That's what's so great about college basketball in March. That's what makes it completely unlike anything else. I was thinking the other day that the two great moments for my sports calendar are, one, the very beginning of UMass football season, that first game. One, it feels like I'm getting closer to basketball and I have something to vaguely tune into because I don't lock in on the Red Sox until October. And I don't really lock into anything from kind of, well, I watch the NBA playoffs fairly closely, but basically from, you know, I go June, July, August with nothing, and then I get the start of the college football season. But the reason I get interested in that moment in college football is because, and I've said it on the show, there's this crazy delusional moment where you're just as relevant as Alabama and every other program in the country, and UMass usually starts the year with kind of a respectable but struggling Power Five school, and the hope is always you win that and all of a sudden this little niche thing you care about is on the radar a little bit, and that's all you can ask for. You're just getting it on the radar of the sports world more broadly a little bit for a second, right? And the two moments for that are the first day of college football season, you know, when we were up on Rutgers and it was like a Friday game and there weren't many games yet that had been played. You're looking on Twitter and just people who care about the sport are watching your team and they're like, oh, UMass 21-7. You know, it's this little glimpse of like what it could be like. And that's what it's like being a UMass fan, I think. It's kind of like you're not really yet in that national conversation, but you're close enough that you're kind of like looking for signs and you're just waiting to break through. So that, and then annually, the Atlantic 10 tournament, because there's always weird shit that happens and you're hoping one of these years it'll be your team that is at the center of that weird shit happening. And this is a year that, you know, you can understand why people would think UMass might be a team they don't want to play down there. So can they make a run? Well, probably not. And I think part of that is a function of, I think if they were to, there's a lot of things that have to go right. Sean East has to not turn the ball over and has to return to form that we saw early in the season, because you just need a point guard to get you through a lot of that stuff. Carl Pierre and Tabaji Walker have to make threes, because you gotta make the games interesting by hitting open shots and not just grinding it out. You gotta kind of take a lead and win one of those games by 16 or something, so you get your guys a little rest for the next day. You know, the truth is, if you think about the teams that have done things in college, in Atlantic 10, but in college basketball in general, really in the Atlantic 10 tournament, it's guards. It's guys who take over games as guards and get hot for a few days. And, you know, our best player is a freshman big. And I just think, you know, so I have some concerns.
Never say never. You know, it's funny, I think there's another question about this tonight, but UMass is like, if they end up better than 10th, that's good for the program, but it's bad for the A-10 tournament, because it means you're going to play an 8-9 game against a decent team, and then you get Dayton. And you just want to avoid Dayton. They've been so dominant. Do I think it's impossible, you know, that UMass could, you know,
beat them? But they're really good, and like, they'll be rested coming into that game, and you know, I kind of want to avoid them. So, yeah. All right. What else we got here? Minute fan Dan D. Dunf 9. Are you going to the official pregame at McMurphy's before the URI game? I don't think so. This may be the first year in, boy, oh boy, I think maybe in like 17 years that I don't get to a game at the Mullen Center. And that's what happens when you have a second kid and you live 3 hours away. It's just really fucking hard. I've been to 4 games this year, and I'll go to the games in Brooklyn. But getting to Mullins on a weekend, man, with a 2-month-old, a 3-month-old, is just fucking hard. I you know, I was gonna do it for Dayton, then he went to the hospital, and it's just, so I don't think I'm gonna be there. I want to do it. I'm gonna look into it. If I go up there, I try to get. Excuse me, try to get there for the pregame, but yeah. I just got a question from Real Mike R91 saying, Vance Wahlberg? That's funny. I'm not going to respond to it, but it's funny. Then he also said, should this team ditch this three since they're shooting a red hot 28% conference play? I mean, you can't ditch the three. And this is what people I don't think are getting. Like, there's this tendency to say, okay, UMass has gone cold from three. They were pretty good in the earlier part.
TJ was there. They've gone cold from three, so ditch it. Don't go to that.
That supposes that there's another option. And other than Trey, who's often double and triple teamed, you don't really have a lot of options. Because, as I've said all year, has been the kind of perennial thorn in our side all season, is we don't have a guard who can consistently get to the rim off the dribble or get to the foul line, you know, by getting in the lane and getting fouled. We just don't have that guy on this team. The good teams in the Atlantic 10 do. VCU has like 3 or 4 of those guys, one of whom is injured. But the point is, when VCU is playing well, you know, if you recall last year, they're just moving the ball around and lots of guys are able to sort of dribble drive and get in the lane. And that keeps the entire offense moving and gets guys open looks and leads to various things. You know, Carl has improved as a slasher, but he's not like a you know, hey, go one-on-one, take this dude off the bounce. Dude, that's just not his game. Preston, you know, he's been great, and he gets a lot of steals in transition, and he does exciting things, and he occasionally hits a three, and, you know, he can get in motion, and, you know, when the ball is moving, he can, you know, kind of go baseline, and there's things he can do. But again, he's not like a Gary Forbes type guard where you just get him the ball and he kind of dribble, breaks a dude down, and eventually gets a good look. That's just not who he is. Sean East, you know, when he's in motion and we're playing a more full court up-tempo game, he can make some things happen in transition. I still would like to see him off the ball a little bit at times, because I think when you get him going downhill, he can do interesting things. But then you have defensive issues, because you have him and Colton, you know, both playing, and you're kind of, it's harder to guard when you have two kind of small-ish freshman point guards out there. You know, and then Debaji Walker, I think, and this is why I'm so high on him despite some of his struggles, is he's the only guy who can create his own shot other than Trey, and who can create it 15, 20 feet from the basket. And, but even him, like, it's interesting, like, when he has had those great nights, he'll hit these, like, difficult 14-footers in a dude's eye, as opposed to, like, taking him off the bounce and getting, you know, a layup or getting fouled. So I note all that to go back to the original question, because what else do you want us to do? If Trey Mitchell is triple-teamed and he kicks out and there's Carl Pierre wide open for three, that's a good shot. You know, in the context of the offense, that is a good look. Likewise with Debaji Walker, even though he's missed a lot of them. Samba Diallo is probably 4 for 30 this year from three, and he gets great looks every time. You're like, well, I guess he's got to shoot it, you know, but virtually every time. But it doesn't go in. So, yeah, would I like Samba to stop shooting threes? Yeah. Trey, you know, he doesn't shoot them at a high clip, but they often look good coming off his hands. I don't mind him taking a couple. Preston's, you know, they don't always look good, but they often go in, it feels like, especially at, like, opportune clutch moments. But, yeah, I mean, you can't ditch the three without, a couple guards who can get you easy looks, because I would rather you take an open three than a low percentage two. Right, that's like kind of the basic analytics of today's game, and I think that's kind of a no-brainer. So,
you're not in a great spot, I acknowledge that, but I need to hear an alternative,
because you can't have Trey take... I mean, look, you can make a case that Trey should take 40 shots a game, but the truth is, at a certain point, teams would quadruple team him, you know? I mean, it's just... And as he's drawing so many defenders, you know, guys have to fucking step up and make shots. It's just, that's the reality of it. Riff Raff Street Pat P Veal 7, a good friend of the show, says, what changes made recently that have resulted in improved play are most important to maintain through the end of the season, and can they carry over into next year? Also, any concern on over relying on Trey on offense? Very tough to get good looks when he's out IMO. Always good questions from Pat. To go to the first point, I think the changes recently that have resulted in improved play are the switches in defense, in particular, going with some zone, mixing it up. And Amin Torre for the Daily Collegian wrote about this today, because I actually asked him a similar question as what Pat's asking me, but I asked it specifically about whether it was the zone that's helped us get better. And he answered it very smartly, where he was talking about that's part of it, but it's also just that we're mixing it in alongside other things, and it's throwing opponents off, and I think he's totally right. However, I'm not sure that is the thing that will make this team that needs to carry into next year, because I think next year we're going to be able to play. I think the press that has been at times good this year, but for much of the early part of the season was kind of disastrous, will be a lot easier to play when we have Garcia and McCrory and some other guys. And I don't know if like this zone that we're seeing right now is necessarily going to be a key factor heading into another season. So I think the big one is just effort. I mean, it seems simple, but they've just been playing a lot harder, you can tell. And I think understanding that is essential, because it kind of, and again, it sounds cliche, but it's how you win, right? Like it's understanding those sort of winning habits, and those are carrying over. So it's maybe that's a little bit of an intangible, but I also think improved play of DeBaggio Walker in terms of getting him the ball in space and understanding how he can be effective is big, because he's only going to get better and better. And I think his upside is through the roof. So he says, any concern over relying on Trey offense? I mean, you're always concerned when that's the case, but you also have a generational talent and you can't not exploit that as much as possible. You'd be irresponsible and reckless not to. I think, frankly, there were points earlier in the season where Matt didn't rely on him enough, or he didn't over rely on him, I should say, and it wasn't to good effect. If you look at when we've over relied on him, we've either won or played really good teams very respectably. So over reliance hasn't really caused losses. You know, there were guys in the past, like, whose usage was so high, and, you know, like Trey Davis and Dante Clark come to mind. They had the ball in their hands a ton, and they scored a lot, but it felt very inefficient. It felt like it wasn't in the flow of the offense. It was a lot of one-on-one. Trey Mitchell's not like that, so I'm not really concerned about it, no. I do think that... it speaks to the need to get DeBaggio and Carl hot, because you can't always rely on Trey. And there's going to be a time, what, you know, it could be at Richmond, Grant Golden, you know, their big man could draw 2-3 fouls on Trey in the first half, and you could be in a lot of trouble early. That happened at one point earlier this year. I forget against who, but, you know, I'm always modestly concerned. But in terms of the list of things I'm worried about with this group, it's not really anywhere close. So UMass Reindeer kid who sports reindeer regalia at all of the home games, so go say hello to him, said next year at this point record. So he wants to know what the record is at this point next year. Boy, oh boy, it's a great question. It's very difficult to say. Right now, the non-conference slate is looking considerably more manageable than this year. There was some news this week that UMass will be playing in Jamaica in a tournament featuring the marquee opponents, evidently, are Wake Forest, who's like 11-15 and has struggled. They may have a first-year coach next year if Manning is let go, and Missouri State. So, and then I guess we have Rutgers coming to the Mullins, but that might be the next year, actually. So the reality is the schedule's not expected to be anywhere as difficult as it was this year. So it wouldn't be at all inconceivable. It could change, but it wouldn't be inconceivable that it be like they should be 10-3, 11-2 in the non-conference. Conference is going to be even better than this year. It's going to be absolutely loaded. And so I think the goal would kind of be like a 10-11 win league slate. So you figure at this point, four games shy, they would be kind of like 8-6, 9-5 in league, and maybe 10-3, 11-2 in non-conference, depending on what happens with the schedule. So kind of somewhere between 20-7 and 17-18 and, you know, 10-11. So I think 17-11 is you know, kind of a good thing to hope for on the like very good low end. And that 20 would be like outrageously impressive, but not inconceivable, depending on, but, you know, not inconceivable that UMass could be 7-7 in the league, and, you know, 9-4 in a non-conference that I'm not anticipating, and be like 16-8. It's a good question. Next question comes from Son of Large Mark, who says, great friend of the show, expectations for the rest of the year. Also, not a question, more of a statement. It's nice to see Debaji coming into his own a little bit. I think he might have the highest non-tray ceiling on the team. I absolutely couldn't agree more. I've been saying that since like the first time I saw the guy touch a basketball. I know he's had some off nights. I know his shot hasn't always been there. But if you look at what this kid can do in space when he catches the ball 12, 13, 14, 15 feet from the basket, 45 degree angle kind of thing, or even sort of quasi on the baseline, he can go to work. I mean, that spin move, he can dribble, he can step back and shoot the three. It's not always been there, but this dude is legit. I mean, he has a really unique game and almost an NBA-like set of skills. And when he starts shooting the shit out of the ball, look out. So, expectations for the rest of the year? Honestly, I know it's a cop-out, but I just want to see them play really hard and win at least one. They should steal at least one of the home two, beat LaSalle on the road. Dan underscore Mayo, M-A-I-O, great friend of the show. Assuming you mean pod questions, yes, he says. Does the A-10 tourney reseed? If not, would you rather finish 8th or 9th, highest in the standings, but be in Dayton's side, or 10th, lower in standings, and be opposite of Dayton? Yeah, I actually alluded to that, Dan, a little bit earlier. It does not reseed, so if you are the 9 seed and you beat the 8, you get the 1, and if you beat the 1, it's not like you go and get a lower seeded team, if that makes sense. It's so hard. Selfishly, I kind of want to finish 10th because the game is a little bit later in the day and it'd be easier for me to get to, but you always want to finish as high as you can. And you know, the tendency is like, I don't want to finish 8th or 9th because then I have to get Dayton. But maybe if you're going to get him anyway, fuck it. You want to finish as high as you can. He then has chances of getting to 7th, which would be both higher in standings and opposite of Dayton. So I think that the chances there are slim because the top like 5, 6 are already pretty solidified. Richmond and Rhodey are kind of competing for 2. So one of them will probably finish 3rd. And then Bonaventure seems poised to get the 4 spot. And then St. Louis and Duquesne are, I think, both 8 and 6. I don't have them in front of me, but that's kind of your 5, 6. I'm not really getting around them. Boy, I'm so fucking tired. I don't know what I'm answering right now. So chances of getting 7th, I think they basically have to win out, because that would get them to 10 wins, and even like the 5-6 teams already have 8 wins and they're probably going to go 2-2. So you'd have to kind of definitively overpass all the teams in your tier, Davidson, VCU types, St. Louis. Yeah. Or no, St. Louis is 8-6. Again, I don't know what I'm saying. I'm so out of it right now, but this could be interesting for that. It's almost like I'm doing a drunk show at this point. Kevin Rodak says, does UMass win our regular season? And then he says, yep. I don't know what that means, but Kev, thanks for the question. That's all I got for tonight. You guys have been great.